Courage cannot erase our fear. Courage is when we face our fear. Tell those with power, safe in their tower, we will not obey.
Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today. We've got two great reports this week. One on a labor history event you may have heard of before if you're a regular LHT listener. The other you almost certainly have never heard of. I certainly hadn't.
And it's one of the largest labor massacres in U.S. history. And that's why it's so interesting and so puzzling that it's not part of the national public memory.
That's Paul Shackle, author of Remembering Latimer, Labor, Migration, and Race in Pennsylvania Anthracite Country. The Cool Things from the Meany Archive crew caught up with him last week at the University of Maryland at College Park.
It may be evil, but it's not stupid. If a $5 test can tell an employer that a specific applicant is significantly more likely to come down with a very expensive disease in the foreseeable future, it's in the employer's best interest to hire somebody else.
The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act took effect 10 years ago this week. How did such a major workplace protection measure manage to get passed into law in the final year of the George W. Bush administration? Patrick Dixon spoke to Lewis Maltby to find out. Newsies, the toe-tapping musical that tells the inspiring story of New York City newsboys taking on powerful publishers in 1899, is on stage now at Arena Stage here in Washington, D.C. We thought you'd enjoy a sneak preview. All right, here's this week's show. Paul Shackle is the author of Remembering Latimer, Labor, Migration, and Race in Pennsylvania Anthracite Country. We had him on the show earlier this year, but when he was giving a lecture at the University of Maryland at College Park last week, we couldn't resist a chance to send LHT contributors Ben Blake and Alan Weirdak to check in and find out more about this historic but little-known chapter in American labor history. Here's Alan.
Hello, everyone. We're here with another segment of Cool Things in the Meany Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with the labor archivist, Ben Blake. And today we are actually venturing slightly outside of the Meany Labor Archives to one of our other libraries, McKeldin Library. And we are joined by professor and department chair of anthropology, Paul Shackle. Paul has just put out a book on the Latimer Massacre titled Remembering Latimer that came out in 2018. Paul just presented to people at McKeldin Library about the book and his research. So I guess my first question, Paul, is what got you interested in Latimer?
Well, that's a great question. So I worked for a long time for the National Park Service, and I worked at Harpers Ferry National Historical Park. And the issues that I worked on were related to early industry and work and labor. And in 1997, I was still working for the Park Service and I was transitioning to Maryland. And a friend of mine told me about a centennial at Latimer, and I had no idea what Latimer was. And I saw a little write-up about it. So I convinced my wife to take a weekend trip and to go up to the Hazleton area and try to figure out what this Latimer event was all about. So we came up here in 1997, and that was the 100th anniversary of the Latimer Massacre. And it was a two-day event here, and they had some scholars and some historians who were talking about Latimer and the significance of Latimer. There was a ceremony at the Latimer Massacre site. The state unveiled two of their roadside markers, one at Harwood, which was the start of the march for the Latimer Massacre, and the other one was at Latimer. They redid the roadside marker there. It was 2 days of events, and And I said to myself, you know, this is really interesting because most people outside of this area don't know about Latimer. This is really important labor history. And I said to my wife, I said, you know, at some point I'd like to come back up here and do some work. So when I became chair of the Department of Anthropology, I was given a graduate student to help me with my research. And so I asked her, you know, can you develop a web page? And I'd like to see if I could get some interest in Latimer. And she developed a web page. And within a couple of days, a lot of the locals were contacting her and saying, hey, we have information. Hey, we have some information about Latimer. Hey, I know so-and-so who could tell you more about Latimer. And so I made the trip up.
Going from there, you commented on two things that I'm really interested about. And one of them is this idea of the national public memory surrounding Latimer, and also the historical significance, not just from a labor context, but also from an immigration context. So I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Well, what's interesting is that Latimer is not and was not part of the national public memory. So when you look at a lot of the history books that have been written, Latimer is not in it.
Right.
You know, and when you read Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, it's a footnote in reference to the sinking of the Maine. It says something about the exploitation of workers like at Latimer. It's one of the major labor events in U.S. history, but it's not in the history books. And so so I was puzzled for a long time, you know, why isn't it part of the national public memory? And isn't it time that it become part of the national public memory? And now, the issue related to immigration is a fascinating issue because Latimer is a history of immigration. And the coal mining that occurred in northeastern Pennsylvania is a history of immigration of the United States, where the early coal miners were of English and Welsh and German descent. And then you have the Irish migration that comes in the 1840s and 1850s. They're the new laborers. And then they eventually become the foremen. And then the new immigrants were the people from Southern and Eastern Europe. So coal mining really is about a history of immigration of these different groups coming into the coal mining region.
I guess one way of keeping it in the national collective public memory is to tie it in with other coal mining immigrant-based strikes like in Ludlow. So I know you briefly touch on Ludlow in your book, but could you talk about joining Latimer with other coal strikes to kind of bring them all together to this national public memory around coal labor unrest and immigration?
So that's a tough question. You know, I mean, how do you do something like that? And it's really tough. I'm thinking about the UMWA and right. How they commemorate these events. And these events are usually very separate. Today I talked a little bit about universals, and mm-hmm. There's a universal that connects all of them.
Right.
Right. But are people in Colorado willing to connect to northeastern Pennsylvania, you know, or do they want to commemorate their own event? And I think that's the issue. And I think that's why these events remain very separate. You know, I would think that the traditional white population that has connections to Latimer want to remember Latimer, you know, and so that's a tough job. And that's a job that some large organization needs to put forward. And I put that on the shoulders of the UMWA. I mean, they need to think about how to connect them, because if you connect them, you have strength. And what the UMWA is doing now, or what I've noticed over the past couple of decades, is that they've been very good about commemorating and putting markers on the landscape to commemorate events. And that's how you keep these events in the public memory, if you have markers out there. And that's why creating the Latimer Memorial in 1972 was so important. There's a place there and it's visible on the landscape. So the next step is you need this larger organization to identify these universals. We're talking about immigration history. You know, that's one of the universal. It's immigration history. It's about labor. It's about working for social justice issues. These are all the common denominators that work across all these sites. But it really takes a larger effort to bring them all together. And like I said a minute ago, you know, there's power in unity.
Yeah.
Maybe you'd talk a little bit about what happened at Latimer and why is that important?
Latimer is the culmination of a lot of labor strife in northeastern Pennsylvania. There's a lot of new immigrants coming in from southern and eastern Europe, and there's a lot of anti-immigration sentiment in the traditional population. So the state legislators are trying to pass laws, and they're asking Congress to think about immigration laws. And the state of Pennsylvania legislators twice asked the U.S. Congress to pass these anti-immigration laws. They don't. So the state of Pennsylvania passed this act called the Campbell Act, which is a tax on all unnaturalized workers. And this is supported by the UMWA to support the traditional white English-speaking population. And once the workers see that they're being taxed 3 cents a day and they're not making much money as it is because it's the end of this recession and they're making $1.50 a day, right? And they're working 2 days a week, maybe 3 days a week. And then all of a sudden they see this tax on top of all this other money being taken out of their paycheck, like the dynamite and their food and other equipment that they need. They go on strike and they start closing down all the mines in the region. And their strategy was to close down all the mines related to one company. If they could close down all the mines, they wouldn't have production and they wouldn't have any income and perhaps they would have some clout. So the events at Latimer were about closing the last mine that was operated and owned by the Pardee family. The march started on September 10th around noon. And the march went all the ways to Latimer, which was several hours of marching, and by all recollection, and it was a warm day, and they get just outside of Latimer, and they're met by the sheriff and his posse. There's a posse of 86 men. There's probably coal and iron police that are joining the front, and they line up parallel to the road and also protecting the coal breaker. And that was the goal, was to march to the coal breaker and shut the coal breaker down and shut the mines down. And the sheriff comes out to meet the miners at the road, and the posse are still lined up. And he says, halt, you can't go there, disperse, you can't march. And the miners say, this is a public road, we have a right to be here. And there's an argument, and there's a scuffle. And there's a lot of different accounts that's recorded in the newspapers, but somebody yells fire, and they start firing into these men. And these men are unarmed, and several drop at that moment, and others start running away. And as they're running away, the posse starts shooting into the crowd, and they're shooting these men in their backs. 19 men die that day at Latimer, and a total of 25 die related to gun wounds. And the majority of the gun wounds are from shots taken from the back as they were running away. And it's one of the largest labor massacres in U.S. history. And that's why it's so interesting, so puzzling that it's not part of the national public memory, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. One thing that I noticed about your archaeological work was that you have this focus on not just immigration, but also in involving the community. And I was wondering if you could speak to the significance of bringing the community of Hazleton in to do this work instead of just going in there and, you know, not necessarily doing it yourself, but doing it with graduate students.
There's a couple of reasons why I think it's important to involve the community. And one is, it's their history. And so by involving the community, they're building their history. I don't want to be the academic who comes in and tells them about their history, but they're actually discovering it, and we're discovering it together.
One thing I'm curious about is about the reception of your work, like from the local community throughout, you know, from when you started through the election of Donald Trump. How has your work been received by not just the community that you're working with, but the community that you aren't working with?
Yeah, so I'll start with the community that I am working with. A lot of the traditional white population, they're very appreciative of the work that we're doing, because the folks in northeastern Pennsylvania feel forgotten. There has not been a long-term historical or archaeological project in northeastern Pennsylvania. People feel like their history is important, and they really see us as helping them to recover their histories. What's often difficult is that we're from the University of Maryland going into Pennsylvania, and we're often seen by some as outsiders. And that has created some tension. So people who don't know us and who don't know that we've been there for 10 years working with the local community see us as outsiders and academics coming in and telling people what their history should be. I think that's part of what we need to do better, is to communicate with those people who see us as outsiders and try to bring them into the community or try to bring them into the process of developing their heritage.
For my last question, the book is out. I've gotten some mixed reactions. What are the next steps? What does the future hold for this project?
So the next step is to think harder about the new immigrant in the community and get them to be a part of the heritage building in northeastern Pennsylvania. And what we want to do is work with the Anthracite Heritage Museum in developing an exhibit about immigration and how people think about the region's heritage and the region's anthracite heritage. So I could almost see panels where somebody who has roots in the area, long-term roots, describing one universal, you know, about work or about education or about health, and then a panel next to of one of the new immigrants talking about one of these universals, about health and education, and trying to bridge the divide by connecting with these universals. And so that's what I hope to do.
I don't know, it's like, as you were talking about in your presentation, the, you know, the first wave being English, Welsh, and German, the second wave being predominantly Slovak, Eastern European, and then there's almost this third wave where it's like a continuity, where it's not necessarily continued on the same labor, coal mining, but still labor. You know, I mean, there's still, these populations are still pulled into this area, seemingly mostly for work.
For low wage work. Okay, so the coal miners were low wage work. And then you had this anti-immigration legislation passed in 1921 and 1924, which ended the migration in the area. So we don't see any new migration until the 1990s, the late 90s and early 20th century. And they're attracted by this low wage work in often terrible conditions. And so 100 years ago, we had this unchecked capitalism, you know, where we didn't have benefits or health and safety codes. And now we have a lot of these big businesses coming in there who are not protecting the workers and who are often contractors working for 120 days and then they're released. And these people don't have health benefits or insurance and so forth. So I see this as another tragedy and another episode of unchecked capitalism.
Absolutely.
Which is being sanctioned by the government.
So how does remembering Latimer inform labor struggles in the future?
I think remembering Latimer is about creating these universals, and I'm hoping that it creates a unifying voice between peoples of all different groups. So when Cesar Chavez got up there and he talked about Latimer, and he said these are about the immigrants, you know, the only crime that they did was that they were poor and they were immigrants. And he was making connections to his movement, the United Farm Workers, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's what Latimer can be. It could be a place where people can connect, and it could be a place where they rally, and it potentially could be a place that they could think about unionization, right? All these people working in the fulfillment centers. And so I think people need to remember what happened in the past, that the past was a struggle, but the UMWA came around and accepted the new immigrants. And they had victory after victory after they accepted them. You know, the 1900 coal strike and the 1902 coal strike. They were major events in WA history. And I think thinking about that and thinking about the possibilities, you know, there could potentially be a very different future for the workers in northeastern Pennsylvania.
All right, well, that about wraps it up. Dr. Shackle, thank you so much for taking the time out to talk with us. Remembering Latimer, we can't recommend it enough as a work that intersects labor, immigration, and this conflict between labor and capital. So thank you.
It's been great.
Yeah. This has been another segment of Cool Things in the Media Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with the labor archivist, Ben Blake, and Dr. Paul Shackle. Till next time.
Newsies, the toe-tapping musical that tells the story of New York City newsboys taking on powerful publishers in 1899, is playing now at Arena Stage here in Washington, D.C. I caught the show last week and just had to include a quick report on it on this week's podcast. As labor theater impresario Elise Bryant put it, "Rousing music, fabulous dancing, and an inspiring story about young workers standing up for their rights. See it."
5, 6, 7, and
strike! 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 Strike!
With strikes in the news every day, including the 3-week-old walkout by bus drivers in Lorton, Virginia, seeing Newsies at Arena Stage last week was an incredible experience. To see our struggles brought to life on the stage was emotionally moving and completely inspirational. The story Newsies dramatizes, New York City newsboys taking on powerful publishers in 1899, is over a century old, yet the battle for workplace justice is exactly the same as that being fought today by the Lorton bus driver, Chicago teachers, and GM auto workers, and the singing and dancing by the cast of young actors, members of Actors Equity, is simply phenomenal. To order tickets for the December 13th performance, which includes a special labor talkback, go to dclabor.org and click on calendar.
5, 6, 7, and
now it's time to seize the day.
I'd never heard of the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, and it turns out not many have, but this significant piece of workplace legislation took effect 10 years ago this week on November 21st, 2009. Also known as GINA, the law prohibits employers from using applicants' genetic information when making hiring decisions. While this law was nearly 2 decades in the making, it passed through Congress with nearly unanimous consent. Indeed, only Ron Paul in the House of Representatives voted against it. How did such a major workplace protection measure manage to get passed into law in the final year of the George W. Bush administration? Patrick Dixon spoke to Lewis Maltby to find out. Lewis is the founder of the National Work Rights Institute and was previously the Director of Employment Rights for the ACLU. Here's Patrick.
November 21st, 2009, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act was passed. Can you tell me how this came about and what its significance was, please?
Sure. GINA was 18 years in the making. There used to be a thing, Patrick, do you remember, called the Congressional Office of Technology Assessment? It was basically Congress's private think tank. And at that point, genetic breakthroughs were just beginning, and no one knew what the implications were, but Congress asked their private think tank, OTA, it was called, to take a look. And OTA asked a number of people to come in, geneticists, civil rights lawyers, and me because I was then director of employment rights for the ACLU. I had never thought much about genetics, but when I got in the room and the geneticist started to speak, I just about fainted. What the geneticist told the rest of us was that they now knew how to decode the genome, human genome. And all I thought to think was, well, if they can do it, there's enough forces involved that it will get done. This will not be one of those projects that could be done but doesn't get done. It will get done. And when it's done, we know there are genes that are linked to breast cancer and Alzheimer's and Huntington's and all sorts of horrible diseases. When they decode the genome, they'll find those specific genes. And after that, they will learn how to test for those specific genes. And eventually, those tests will be relatively inexpensive. And at that point, anyone who, what we now call BRCA1 positive, will never get a job for the rest of their life. Employers will use it as a pre-employment screen. It may be evil, but it's not stupid. If a $5 test can tell an employer that a specific applicant is significantly more likely to come down with a very expensive disease in the foreseeable future, it's in the employer's best interest to hire somebody else. And so at that point, I decided, this can't happen. We have to stop this. And it took 19 years. We had to talk, we had to have conferences, we had to get state laws passed. Eventually we got to Congress, and eventually GINA was passed. But if it hadn't been, we would be rapidly approaching a day when anyone who's carrying a genetic mutation linked to an expensive disease would be unemployable. It's the most important law most people will never hear of. It's good that people don't know about it, because it means that we got GINA passed before the problem hit.
When this came up in 1990, did Congress not really take it as seriously as you did? Did labor unions think about this as a potential problem? Who were some of the people you were engaging with?
There were some very far-sighted folks in the labor movement who could see it. There were a handful of very far-sighted academics who could see it. We were looking so far downstream that there was a handful of people in 1990 who could see what was going to be coming someday. And it was very much an ad hoc group of people.
And was the trick then to curtail the ability of insurance companies or employers? What was the goal?
Well, the ultimate goal was to protect people who carry genes linked to serious diseases from employment discrimination. And along the way, we realized that medical insurance was also going to be an issue. I'm more of an employment guy, so I didn't think about that first, but it was equally a problem. Denying insurance to people who are likely to need it is what insurance companies
right.
do.
Right.
So if it had become possible to determine inexpensively which insurance applicants were carrying genes linked to Huntington's or breast cancer, they wouldn't have gotten medical insurance. But fortunately, GINA also prevents that. And one of the things GINA does, which is unusual, most civil rights laws simply say an employer can't do this or can't do that. GINA goes beyond that, and it says that employers cannot even acquire certain information. In this case, GINA says employers cannot even acquire genetic information about employees or applicants. And the reason is, if they could get it, they would use it. Saying they couldn't would be pointless. So we took the unusual step of saying employers can't get genetic information. They cannot acquire it in any way at all.
So looking at it a decade on, has it been entirely successful in achieving what you set out to do?
It appears to have been reasonably successful. I don't know of any hard data on the subject, but without GINA, we would be seeing widespread discrimination against people with various genetic markers, and I haven't seen any indication of it. So this may be one where we actually succeeded. Genetics is not a major issue in employment today, but medical information is a huge issue. Employers routinely require you to sign a waiver in which your personal physician shows an agent of the company your entire medical file. Now, they're not supposed to turn you down for a reason unless it's related to your ability to do the job. But if that agent of the employer finds out there's something in your medical file that doesn't affect your ability to get the job done, but it's going to affect your medical costs, there's a very good risk you'll be turned down. That goes on every day. Genetics is the one area of medicine where we get it right in employment. Everywhere else, it's pretty much wrong. It would have been nice if we could have succeeded in getting everything changed to the way Gina is, but that just was never accomplished.
Too many oppositional forces.
Too many oppositional forces. One of the reasons that Gina was successful is that we were presenting it to Congress at a point where employers weren't doing it. And employers are no more far-sighted than anyone else. When someone is trying to outlaw a practice that they aren't doing or even thinking about doing, they don't get very worked up about it. So one of the big reasons we were able to get Gina enacted is we got it enacted before employers became invested in the practice. But once employers get invested in a practice, it's almost impossible to get it changed. They just have too much political power.
So the National Association of Manufacturers wasn't ahead of you on this?
No, they weren't. They didn't like it, but they did not make a huge investment in trying to kill it because it didn't affect anything they were actually doing yet. By looking into the future and seeing what was going to happen, we were able to get Gina enacted because it was not yet a problem that was actually affecting anyone and employers weren't invested in carrying out. Whether we could get Gina in passed today is a very interesting question.
That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. Today's music included the original Broadway Newsies cast recording of Seize the Day, and you also heard a bit of Arena Stage's version during rehearsals. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history. And see you next time.
They're gonna see there's hell to pay. Nothing.